Hey everybody, it's Sam Bennett. Thank you so much for joining me for the True Freedom Symposium, the when, what, why, and how to quit your day job, and what's really on the other side. Does the idea of having to pitch yourself sound awful? Are you concerned about being salesy? Today's interview features the extraordinary Sark, Susan Ariel Rainbow Kennedy. She's a best-selling author of like 18 books. She's an artist, an inspirationalist, and acclaimed teacher and mentor. Her purpose in life, and you'll see this all through the interview, is to be an uplifter, transformer, and a laser beam of love. She offers that through her art, words, and spirit. You can find out more about Sark at planetsark.com. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Susan Ariel Rainbow Kennedy. I'm so glad you're here. This is so great. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. You are such an inspiration to so many people. The godmother of us all, the Organized Artist Company would not exist if you and your work did not exist. So a very personal and private thank you from me to you.
Oh, and I guess not so private now.
Not so private now. There I go, letting the cat out of the bag.
So we're talking to people who have a day gig, they have a career, they're looking sort of sideways at entrepreneurship like, oh, I wonder who that is across the crowded room. And I really just want to give people enough stories and anecdotes and information and insights to really just be able to make a decision. To be able to say like, yep, I would like to find out more about that, or nope, that is not for me. So to start out, why don't you tell the nice people how you got from where you were to where you are?
Oh, yes. Well, and let's be sure, because, you know, believe it or not, not everyone knows Sark, you know.
What? So, impossible.
Let's make sure people know. Well, first of all, what I want most for people to know is really my purpose. It's to be a transformer and an uplifter and a laser beam of love. And I offer that through my art and my words and my spirit. And yes, I have 17 best-selling books. I've had a company for 30 years. I've made millions and millions of dollars. I've spent millions and millions of dollars. I've made every mistake that you could possibly make, I think, except for going out of business. And I've had every success with more to come of things that I've always dreamed of. So I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I had a grandfather who was my mentor, my great mentor, one of my great mentors. I called him Papa. Mm. And he said, do everything you can think of doing so you know what you don't want to do for the rest of your life. And he told me that at age 14. And I was an overachiever even then, so I got 3 jobs that summer of my 14th year. And from 14 to 26, I had 250 jobs.
Wow.
Yes, and if they lasted more than 4 hours, I counted it, and I kept a little notebook and I wrote it down. I was fired from most of them. I quit the other ones. I found out basically that I was unemployable. I mean, I did pretty well for a day or two in a job, but beyond that, I found out a lot of things I didn't want to do. And I also, there was a lot of humility. I learned to be of service. A lot of jobs were waitress jobs, and I really think that should be a requirement in some way for people to find out what's there. And at 26, I quit all jobs. And I said, I'm an artist and writer, and I'm going to live that way, and I don't care if I have to starve. Well, I shouldn't have said the second part. Then I proceeded to starve. And, you know, I learned a lot. I actually opted out of the money system. So I'm very anomalous in this case, from 26 to 35, and lived on barter and trade. Because I'd hung out with a lot of millionaires and billionaires in my 20s. And I found them to be dramatically unhappy people. And I thought that the problem was the money, but it actually was their consciousness. And so at 35, after a suicide attempt, which I'm happy to say didn't work, I rose up to share my work, and I decided to become the happy, conscious millionaire that I had wanted them to be.
Mm.
And so I found out I was a terrible boss, and you can relate to this. I found out that I didn't believe in time off at all. And I found out there were no real benefits and there was no job security. And what else wasn't there? There were a lot of things that were
no quarterly review. No,
there was no opportunity for a raise. In fact, it was unknown whether there would be money coming, and money was on, it was very unstable. Mm-hmm. You know, there could be a lot of money and then there could be no money. And this was very hard for me to grasp. So I went into debt, as many entrepreneurs do, and have done that multiple times, actually. So I want to make sure, because I think sometimes when people have arrived at a certain time of their life or in a certain place in their life, that it's thought that, you know, you're basically established or you made it or you found it. And I like to tell people, I didn't go to college. I did actually, but I call it collage. So I collaged a lot of things together and I practiced and experimented. So I want to make sure, because I'm so glad you're doing this, Sam, by the way, everybody needs to have this summit, because people have either idealized visions of what it will be like, or they have terrible fears of what it will be like. And the truth lies somewhere in the wonderful, marvelous, messy middle, which is what I call it, where we need to, we feel all of our feelings, but we don't need to spend so much time in the negative ones.
Yes, I love this. All right, so I don't know that I had 250 jobs, but I also had a lot of crazy day gigs. So I think we should have a day gig off.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So name me some of your weirdest day gigs.
Okay, one of the worst jobs ever was putting rubber tips on toy darts that shot out of toy guns. And I worked in a factory and a hunchback woman literally would come over and drag the bag of darts away to weigh them. And now however many you did, you were always behind. And so I was so horrified by this job that I invented a way by accident, but turned out to be a glue squirted in my eye as I was putting one of the tips on. And so I got to go to the nurse's office and lie down. So I duplicated it almost every day. I got glue in my eye. And this is how I knew how different I was. My best friend and I did this job, and there was this terrible buzzer that rang like, and everyone faced the same way, eating giant donuts. They were all really just didn't look healthy. And I just got up and I said, I quit. And she said, you can't quit. We have this job for the whole summer. And I said, not me. And I still remember riding my bicycle away from that factory. And that friend stayed and worked the whole summer. And I'm just going to say it. She became an embittered attorney, you know, and mm-hmm. It was this belief system that you had to be tortured by work.
Oh my gosh. The one job, I walked away from a job one time. It was actually kind of a cush job. It was like front desk reception, executive assistant kind of thing for HDTV when they were a brand new cable station. Like they were sending people out to the affiliate stations to go sell, you know, to get them to add HGTV to their little local channel or local cable. And so it was nice. It was in a nice office. They didn't have very much for me to do because they were a brand new company. So they weren't really sure what they were doing. HGTV was on all the time. So like Victory Garden, I love those shows. And then I get a call like, oh, Sam, we're doing this radio drama with Stephen Dietz. And one of our actresses just quit because she has a fever of 107. Can you come in? And Stephen Dietz is directing, and it's with Ann Archer, and it's with Ed Begley Jr., and it's with Ari Gross. And I'm like, uh-huh, I'll be right there. And I turn to my boss, I'm like, I gotta go. And like, this is when you know that you are just not cut out.
Yeah.
Regular employment. But I was a Whitewater River guide. I delivered flowers. I produced radio dramas. I did scarf tying demonstrations at the department store.
Oh, this is big. Yeah.
It was horrible.
Yeah. I was a crepe demonstrator in a department store and kept burning them in front of audiences of hundreds as I was supposed to be showing how easy the crepe pan was. Yeah. Yeah. My best job was I saw an ad that said inquiring reporter wanted. And I thought, and it said must be able to take photographs and ask questions. I was like, so I called the guy. He said, I'm sorry, we've had 100 applications. And I said, well, you bet. He said, the application. And so I've closed it. And I said, well, you better open the back up because you're going to hire me. And he said, I like your spunk, kid. Come on in here. And I went in and he hired me. And I think it was the longest job I had. But I was, you know, I would stand in front. I remember standing in front of some guy saying, what gets you really excited? And I didn't even correlate that me and my skin tight bodysuit and my whatever the jeans were at that time that, you know, just, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Pathways. So, pathways. Roads taken, roads not taken.
Yes.
So eventually you decide you're going to opt out of the barter thing. You're going to actually make some money. You're going to have your own business. You're going to do it by teaching and writing and making art and helping other people unleash their own creativity. And what was that world like? I mean, how did that work for you?
Well, first of all, I didn't know all that, you know. No. Like, I was living in my magic cottage in San Francisco. As I said, I'd had this terrible suicide attempt that came from, I was abused. I was molested by an older brother, and I had 2 weeks of flashbacks to the incest, and I didn't eat or sleep. And I just thought I should die. I mean, I couldn't think of anything else to do. And thankfully, I will tell this part now, and it is funny, and you have permission to laugh. I didn't know that you had to blow the pilot light out in the oven. And so I put my head in the oven, and then I just started to get really hot and smelled like pizza. And I thought, am I dead? Is this what death is? So when I came out of that experience, I mean, one has to laugh. And I have no shame about it now. And I feel so, so tender towards that young woman who did that, you know, who thought that was, I was deranged. I mean, I hadn't eaten or slept. I mean, I really understand how people, you know, the brain can just do unbelievable things. So I called the suicide prevention line. I thought it was important that I tell someone. And the woman asked me the best question. She said, did you really want to die? Or did you just want the pain to end? And I said, oh, I want the pain to end. And she said, well, get therapy. You need therapy right away. And I said, well, I'm living on barter and trade. And she said, well, there's ways to do it. And, you know, I found somebody with a sliding scale, was $5 a week. And, you know, I managed to get that together. And I went there, and it started about 15 years of therapy. But, you know, I healed. I forgave that brother. I forgave my parents. I moved on. But so here I am in the Magic Cottage, and I have someone over to tea. I'm writing all these journals. I have stacks and stacks of journals. I don't know what they're going to be, but I'm writing. I'm writing, and I'm living as an artist and writer, which is what I wanted to do. And I had written a poster called, I'd written what came turned into a poster. I'd written in my journal something called How to Be an Artist. And this person that was over said, you know, what is that? How do you live? And I said, well, this is how I try to live. And then I started to read it. Stay loose, learn to watch snails, plant impossible gardens, invite someone dangerous to tea. And then this person said, well, that should be a poster. And so I tore it out of my journal and put it on the wall and said, there, now it's a poster. And he said, no, I mean for the world. And I said, well, I don't have any idea how to do that. And he said, well, somebody does. And so I thought, well, I don't know how to find that somebody. I mean, this is what thousands of people that I've mentored have said to me through the years. I wouldn't have any idea how to do that. Right. So I was just the same. Well, then my young cat, whose name was Jupiter, was this wonderful black cat. He was very young at the time, would stand up on his hind legs and peel this poster off the wall. And it would go whoosh on the floor and wake me up. And I'd say, Jupiter, stop it. And then I would carefully fix it back on the wall. This happened 3 times before I caught on that maybe Jupiter was the conduit. Maybe he was telling me something. So I'd seen this store that was also a catalog. It was like a metaphysical store and a catalog. And I brought this crooked, torn out piece of paper over there. And they looked at it and said, this is crooked and strange. What does how to be an art, what does, invite someone dangerous to tea even mean? I mean, they basically said, well, we'll put it in our catalog, but don't expect much. And I said, well, I've been living on barter and trade for 10 years. I don't expect anything, you know? So I got a call 2 days later and they said, we've had 200 orders for your poster. And I immediately calculated 200 times, I think I was charging $30 for a handmade thing. And I thought, well, that's not going to be a living, you know, that's not going to be enough. I mean, that's what I did, you know, 20, 200, that doesn't seem like very many. Until I sat down to handwrite the 200 separate posters with 45 multicolored phrases. And at the end of the 200, I thought, I hope nobody else orders. You know, this is literally what I thought. And I got a call the next day, we have an order for 300 now. And my heart was literally pounding. I thought, well, I don't know what to do. So all I knew to do was sit down and write 300 more. And at the end of these 500 that I hand wrote, I said, I can never handwrite this again. I just can't. So I thought I have to get creative. Now, luckily I hadn't said handwritten. I'd said handmade. So I got high quality color Xerox, hand tore the edges, hand tore the edges of the French reg paper, colored the edges of those, and spray mounted them together. It was still a lot of work. But it was a good thing I thought of that because I got an order for 1,000 the next day. And so I actually made 11,000 handmade pieces. And what really got, you know, scary was that I had written 18 other posters on 18 other subjects. How to really love a child, how to forgive your father, how to relax about money, how to be really alive. So I thought I better start a company. Now, friends, Sam, have teased me about this since. They said, why a company? Like, why did you think I'll start a company? Why didn't you just think I should find someone to produce these posters?
Find a printer.
Yeah. But it was because of the vision that I had. I knew I had books to write. I knew I was a speaker. I knew that there was a Sark spirit that was in me, but it was also in everyone else. And I knew that I was a messenger of that spirit. And so that's what I did. I started my company right then. It was called Camp Sark. And it was me and me. I was the Sark brand. I was literally everything. I was the assistant. I was the creator. I was the salesperson. I did it all from the tiny 200 square foot Magic Cottage here in San Francisco. And then I began to realize that I couldn't do it all. And everybody wanted everything that I made. As soon as I made something, everybody wanted it. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get bigger. I'm going to have to hire people. I don't know. So I hired my first assistant. And the tagline for the company at that time was Camp Sark, where how you feel is more important than what you do.
That's a really interesting core value for a business.
Yes. And there were flaws. There were flaws in that. And I'm very amused to say that some years later, I was known to say, I don't care how you feel. I want to know what you're doing. Yes. Because before long, I had a team. I had two partners. I had a team of six people. I had designers that I worked with. I created 200 products that went around the world. I spoke and taught around the world, and I was creating a best-selling book every year. So, and I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't have the correct team. I didn't have a growth plan. I was making millions of dollars, and I didn't know how to apportion it. I didn't know anything about cost of sales. I thought there was just money, endless money, and it was just always going to be there. And oh my goodness. I mean, you know, and I became very tired and crabby. I became overwhelmed, and it was the classic story of I was working way too hard. I felt that I had to have my hands on everything. And I finally hired a business mentor. And this is where mentoring comes in, because honestly, if I didn't work with mentors to this day, I don't know where I would be.
Because, I totally agree.
Yeah. Because the mentor that came over to my house, I'll never forget the first thing he said. He had this big flip chart. Oh, and by the way, I had to write a check that scared me. Like, I was shaking, and I felt like I was going to be homeless after I wrote this check. And it wasn't even that much. I mean, when I look back at it now, it was a bargain. But it was, at that time, giant for me. So I wrote that check. I just knew that I needed help about things that I didn't know. And I remember he had this big flip chart, and he said, okay, where's the time for your personal life? And I said, excuse me? And he said, what do you do on the weekends? And I was literally like Lady Violet on Downton Abbey, you know, weekend, what's that? And he's the first person that challenged me to start taking weekends off. And I didn't know what to do. Like, I would have the weekend and I would just be staring at a wall. Like, I don't know. I was always Sark. I was always drawing. I was always selling someone something. I was always creating the next thing. And that's, you know, pretty much what I took into therapy. I said, I don't want to just be this giant creative head that makes things and doesn't have a rich, intimate personal life.
Okay. So there's so many things you've said that I want to underline here. This is so great. All right. First of all, I'm so glad you mentioned your pizza episode. You're turning yourself into a personal pan pizza. Because it's, you know, I made a special effort. Actually, one of the interviewees on this summit is my friend Paul Gilmartin, who has a podcast called The Mental Health Happy Hour. And he talks right? It's brilliant. And I just feel like, I mean, and I talk more and more openly about my living with depression and anxiety. And not particularly because
you've written and talked brilliantly about that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's not because I want to particularly, it's not my favorite part of myself, but I just notice other people not talking about it. And I just want to let everybody know, like, you know, lots of us live with this, and it's not an excuse. It's not, I don't know. It's not a crutch. It's not something to hide behind. It's a thing. Like, everybody's got a thing. Like, some people have little kids. Some people have diabetes. Some people have an ailing parent. Some people have depression and anxiety. Some people have all of these things going on at the same time. You know, so everybody's got circumstances. We just manage them and live with them as best we can. So I think sometimes, especially if you're suffering from depression, it's easy to feel like I'm the only one, you know, look how successful Susan is, you know, saying like, oh, nobody must go through this except me. So I just want to say, thank God you didn't know to blow the pilot light out, but yes.
Yeah, let's keep that on the down low so that others don't know that either.
Right, exactly. I will also say there's a great book by Augustine Burroughs called How to Do This, where he talks about that exact thing about suicide and about how it's not that you want to die, it's just that you want the pain to end. And he makes a very compelling case that in fact suicide doesn't even really do that good a job at ending the pain. So might as well get some help and keep living.
Yeah. As my friend says, look at all the things I would have missed. There wouldn't have been any Sark books. I wouldn't have had the love of my life. You know, just a million things. I would have missed it.
Yeah. The other thing I want to point out is that all those 250 jobs, all that impulsivity, all that quitting after 4 hours, like none of that was indicative of a poor work ethic. Or, I mean, clearly you have the ability to hand create 500 posters just because people order them. Like, that's nuts. You know, like your ability to stick to it and to see it through and to make sure it happens, you know, is 100% there. You just have to be engaged and interested to do it, which is why you and I agreed that we were essentially unemployable because we can't really get that interested in other people's things. It's really our own projects.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I'm really noticing is I'm imagining that people with regular jobs would feel like, well, I would start a business, but what if I screw it up? What if I hire the wrong people? What if I don't manage the money properly? What if, you know, I burn myself out? What if, and the answer is, well, you might.
Yeah. And what's literally the worst that can happen? I mean, I'm an example of almost every terrible thing that could happen. And I'm sitting here with the business, with my life, with my abundant health, with my creativity, with all of my dreams. I'm sitting here. I mean, was it Walt Disney that said anything is worth starting badly? He had a whole quote about that. Like, we're always thinking we have to wait. And that's, you know, I always think of one of my another great mentor who died. She wrote a wonderful book called You're Not Old Till You're 90, Best to Be Prepared, However. And she said, oh, Sark, when you talk to your groups and people and things, would you please tell them that if they meditate and do it badly, it still works? And then she said, oh, and by the way, that goes for everything else. And so I thought of that because when I met John, the love of my life, I was convinced I would do that relationship so badly that I would damage him and myself in the process, and it would be a disaster. And instead, it was the best, almost the best, it was literally, it was the best 4 years of my life. And I wrote a book with him. And I, when he died in my arms 2 years ago, I learned that that too could be a wonderful thing. I mean, how could that possibly be a wonderful thing? But it was, because I'm filled with so much love and so much joy and so much secure attachment from that relationship that it changed me forever. And it rewired my brain and it made me a happier person. And how fabulous.
How fabulous. And I have to say, to see you and John together was a lesson in love for all of us. I mean, you guys really lit up a room. It was really special to know him and to know the two of you together. But and the work that you did together, you wrote a book together, you ran workshops together.
Yep.
And this, I started to make some notes the other day about like things that artists know that maybe other people don't know, or like ways that artists think that maybe isn't so common. And one of the things I was thinking about was this incredibly high tolerance for uncertainty. That we get a little idea and then we're really willing to just sort of like start trying things and not have it work and try another draft and not have it work and go to a collaborator and have that go really bad. And this sense of like, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. If it's worth exploring, it's worth, you know, to keep digging until you really know, like, okay, this is really just not going to work, or it's not going to work now. Mm-hmm. With the existing technology, it's not going to work now with the person that I am. You know, maybe I need to wait until I'm more spiritually ready or more emotionally available or some technology. I mean, we couldn't have done this even 5 years ago, right? So I could have had the idea for it, but until the technology was there, it would have been a lot harder. So this tolerance, this willingness to just kind of keep poking at an idea and keep living with it, and to keep getting it out there. This is the other thing that interests me, is like the minute your work hit the air, everybody was like, oh, I gotta have this.
Yes, and let's make sure we talk about the 25 years of procrastination. Let's make sure we talk about that, because I wrote my first book at age 10 and then I didn't publish till age 35. And I was living a wild life and there was a lot to write about. But I was terrified. My procrastinator and perfectionist were so strong that they convinced me that I would probably die if I tried to get it out there. Which, by the way, the words out there to inner critics is a biggest red flag to the biggest bull you can ever. So if you hear yourself saying those words about your work or even about love relationships, I need to get out there, think of another description, because those parts of you will just freak out. It's like, it's not safe. You're going to be in ruins. It's not going to work. You know, so, you know, I like to think of it as, I'd like to share my work with people, you know, and give some different descriptors that will not awaken those inner critics.
Yeah. I have that about the word marketing. Which is just such a dumb word that doesn't really mean anything. It certainly doesn't really have anything to do with what marketing actually is, which is just making friends with people you don't know are your friends yet.
Right.
So I always tell people, just pick another verb.
Yes.
Like, how would you like to interact with people? Would you like to dance with them? Would you like to do magic tricks with them? Would you like to entice them? Would you like to whip them and yell at them? Like, so if you think of that, like, oh, that's right, I've got to go find some people to whip today. Like, that's gonna be much more interesting than, oh, I've got to do my marketing.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So renaming, this actually leads us to another good thing. So I'm thinking about the people who are watching this and they're thinking, you know what, this entrepreneurship is clearly not for me. I do not have this tolerance for risk. I'm not, you know, I actually kind of like what I do, but I do feel like I want to zhuzh up my life. I do want more of my own creative voice in my life. I do want you know, to plug into that side of myself. Because I think you and I believe that everybody's a creative genius.
Yes.
So how do we, how might they get encouraged?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to get immediate control of your inner comparer. Because this is a critic that is very active, and especially when watching interviews or anything online, all of Facebook. Basically, whatever Sam and Sark are doing, I can't do. And they're clearly more creative with more ability to take risks. And everything that we've said, the critic will turn into a reason why they can't do the thing. So you've got to get that under control. And you can do it by stopping the energy. You know, as soon as you feel that compare, just stop. You know, and you can shout and bring your hand down in a chopping motion. Now, it'll scatter, but the thing that it'll come right back. But the thing is, it won't come back in the same way because you're not merged with it. You're not thinking that this is just you. This is actually an aspect of you. There's nothing wrong with inner critics. They're not bad. They're just trying to protect you. So that would be number one. Number two, doing your version. So this may be obvious, but it bears stating. Because again, if you're comparing, you know, well, I thought about doing a business, but now that I heard Sam and Sark talk about it, it, you know, it's very alarming. And they seem, you know, kind of a little crazy and kind of, you know, off the cliff and, you know, all these things. You can be a very humble, sedate, quiet person with your own vision for what you would like to share with the world. And you can be so powerful in your sweet, quiet, endearing, you know, whatever your way is. I just want to say that it's, I'll never forget, you know, Maya Angelou was one of my great, she became my friend and was a mentor to me. And I'll never forget, she told me so many things, but she said, Sark, it's your spirit that people want. It's the spirit. It's not, it's your perspective and it's your spirit. It's not the thing. You know, this is what we're always thinking, that it's the thing. It's the spirit that people are seeking, and only you contain your spirit. And when you stay in that spirit, you will be a magnet. It's just like I was a magnet. I wrote that thing and then I showed it and it was crooked and strange, but it was I'm so excited. It was a magnet, you know, and everybody has that ability to be that magnet of their own spirit.
So one thing I suggest sometimes is to just ask the question, how can I just be a little more me in this moment? How can I be just 1% more me, 10% more me? And what I find sort of fun about that question is that, again, because sometimes being more me means I'm much quieter and much more serious than I might otherwise be. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it means I'm a lot bawdier and I make inappropriately sexual jokes to people that I really shouldn't. you know, sometimes it means I, you know, put a little zhuzh in my email or put a little something on my outfit, or you know, like, how can I make this outfit more me? How can I make this dinner more me? How can I make this conversation with Sark more me? Like, what could I do to just lean in and show up just this much more fully? And what I find is that when I am this much more present in my own life, this much more present for this moment, that magnet thing starts to happen.
Yes. And I love how you put it in the micro, you know, that, because so often we think it has to be macro. Like we think I have to start big, or I have to take my biggest idea and make it happen and get it out there. And then we overwhelm ourselves. I mean, that's why I wrote my book, Make Your Creative Dreams Real, for procrastinators, perfectionists, busy people, and people who would really rather sleep all day. I mean, avoiders too, that was in the subtitle. I mean, it was the longest subtitle ever, but I wanted to cover everybody that would be reading that thinking this doesn't apply to me. So what I want people to hear is it does apply to you. It applies to you. It applies to you how you are right now, not how you are when you get better or you know, figure it out or you hire, you know, how you are right now is a spirit that is expressing in this world. And so let your expressions be seen and known, and let us all help. Let us all join in. I mean, because here's the thing. When any of us gives these gifts, these unique gifts, there's so many people to catch them. There's people that are going, ah, I want that, I want that. And you know, we fear that no one will be there. I mean, when I first wrote my first book, A Creative Companion, I didn't know what would happen. It was handwritten, it was crooked, it looked very odd. You know, I wrote in the back, send me something from your heart. And 10,000 letters a month started arriving. And the mail they had to bring it in bins. I mean, and people were designing cities out of cereal boxes and sending them to me, you know, like an entire town made out of a cereal box. I mean, I still have things in my garage because I haven't been able to part with them. I haven't opened them in years, but it's like, oh my God, those send me something from your heart, you know, a simple thing. So, you know, this is what happens when spirits express. So if you're a spirit and you happen to be listening to this, you have something to express. And this has been said a million times, and I'm going to say it again. There really is only one of you. And I don't care if you believe in parallel universes. I don't care what you believe in. This incarnation of this physical form for this time around is you. And you've got stuff in there that only can come through you. And we want to see it. So get it. Get it. Get going.
Amen. That's church, people. That's church.
That's the Stark Church.
That's the Stark Church. Now, would you talk about micro movements? Because I think Yes. This is such a helpful concept.
Yes. Well, you know, again, a million years ago, 25 years ago, I was had all these creative dreams and I wanted to do everything. And I have a short attention span and I am interested and fascinated by so many things. And so I was always starting and then that's finishing and just being zipping around and, oh, I wanted to do that. Oh, I wanted to start that. So I created this method called the Micro Movement Miracle Method. And it resulted, it completely changed my life. Because what I did was find a way, a micro movement is simply an ignition system. So it's a way to get started. And then it also is something that creates what I call a habit of completion. Because so often we don't finish, but if we have smaller things, we can finish them. And then it begins to build this habit. And you know this from your brilliant books. So, and the way you live. So I started applying this system to everything and I started to see miracles because I, instead of not starting things, I was starting everything. And then I had a system by which to organize it so that every project had a home. I happened to use what I call micro movement wheels. And each wheel became a different subject. And there were times in my studio, I'd have 25 wheels hanging from clotheslines that I was working on. Now, I want to say, some people are horrified when they hear that. Oh my God, I would never want 25 wheels hanging in my home. When I first started, I just did single micro movements on a single post-it. So it wasn't until later that I realized I'm very prolific. So I had, you know, 5 books I was writing at any given time. You know, not everyone's like that. And not everyone needs to be like that. It's actually a little bit exhausting sometimes to be like that. So, but what I learned was watching, I started teaching this around the world and just watching people, and this is my research now, 60% of the time, if you can get started, you will keep going. That's 60%. That's pretty high.
Wow. Now,
yeah, it's a full 60%. Now, you know, that means 40% you're not doing anything. But here's the wonderful news. The brain doesn't care if you're doing 5 minutes or 5 hours. It just knows that something's underway. Now, most people have creative dreams that don't even make it on a list. So, you know, let's say you want to write a novel. It's not even showing up on a list of things that you want to do. It's just in your mind at the back. It's in a drawer. It's in a computer. It's just kind of there. Oh, I know. I just always want to write a novel. Well, in a micro movement method, you would be encouraged in this case to make a wheel and you would write something in the center of the wheel. It was not write my novel because it sounds so boring. It's like, oh my God, who wants to do it? Nobody. If you write, you know, create my incredible luminous novel. All of a sudden you're like, create my incredible luminous novel. That is how I've always thought of it. And then you're going to choose a micro movement. Now, I worked with this woman, which was a wonderful client some years ago, and her micro movement was get the index box out of my closet, get the box with index cards out of my closet. And I said, well, how does that feel? And she said, oh, it's terrible. I haven't done it in 10 years. And I said, well, it's because it sucks. Like, it's, you're never going to do that micro movement. That's not a micro movement. And she said, well, what is it? I said, you have to find some way to delight or amuse yourself. Otherwise, it's just like a list. I said, how about get my index cards out of the closet and hurl the box in the air. And wherever they land, pick up a card and start writing. She used that same micro movement over and over and over again to finish her wonderful, incredible, luminous novel, which she had said she wanted to write for 10 years. I have literally thousands of micro-movement miracle stories. And I mean, there's so many, I can't even, I will say one more because it's irresistible. Two more, actually. A woman who wanted to create an incredible garden. And she wrote in the center of her wheel, create magical garden. And I said, what's your micro movement? She said, go get fertilizer. I said, okay, like that's the worst micro movement I've ever heard. She said, I know, I never do it. It just sounds terrible. And I said, well, what else can you do? And we came up with that she would write, have a fertilizer adventure. So she went to the garden store, met a man, became lovers with him, and had a fertilizer adventure.
Love it.
Yeah. And then my probably all-time favorite was a woman who, oh, it was a book that became a mentor to my book. I can't think of the title in this moment, but the woman that did the art for the book had ALS, and she was only able to paint at that point using her teeth and a paintbrush. And so they were trying to help her, and you know, she was vibrant, she was doing all these things, but she had only some of her abilities. And so this woman came to my talk, and I asked for people to stand on the stage and announce their creative dream and then announce their micro movement. And she came and said, my creative dream is to help my friend, the artist with ALS, get her painting of the Pope brought to the Vatican and presented to the Pope in person. And I said, what's your micro movement? And she said, this is it, standing up here and telling that story. And I said, okay, audience, who do we have? Within 5 minutes, we had a flight to Rome paid for, hotel for her and her students that had all done the background of the painting to help the woman, and an audience with the Pope.
Dude.
Yeah.
But this is what happens when you step outside of the, oh, I have to, and it's going to be hard, and I better struggle, and I don't have time, and I'm so overwhelmed, and barda, 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 and start to go, well, what if it were fun? What if it did defy all odds? That happens all the time.
Right. And like, who do we know? And now that we have this technology, you can put one Instagram post, you can put one tweet, you can put one thing. Who knows somebody that creates products? Who knows somebody that can book me speaking gigs? Who knows somebody that can help me incorporate? Who knows? I mean, like, but here's the thing. People don't ask. Right. They're so afraid and convinced that it won't happen that they don't even ask.
Right.
And then I catch them and I say to them, well, when did you, and then I catch myself. Because I'm having to ask for new things now, and they're scary. You know, you risk rejection. You risk nobody answering on your thread. You know, your post just sits there. You know, you cannot know where your things might travel if you don't ask.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this woman standing on the stage, received three things. Look at that. Audience with the Pope? Who can arrange that? A flight overseas to Europe for her and seven students? Who can arrange that? You know, they were all sitting there in the audience.
So here's the other thing I love about your work, and I think something we have in common in the way that we teach and approach our work and our creativity, is really stripping the special away from it. Like, you do not need 6 months in Provence. You do not need, you know, to light a candle and be in a certain mood and have all the right equipment and all the right tools. It's like, no, no, right as you are, right today, with everything that you know and don't know and can do and can't do, just start. And what you find is that, in fact, the special is everywhere.
Yes.
The magic is everywhere and the miracles are everywhere.
Yes, yes. And to that, I will offer this quote that I said and live by, which is, action comes before inspiration.
Say that again.
Action comes before inspiration. It's counterintuitive, and we're taught the opposite. You should wait for inspiration. Inspiration may come and it may not come. Let me tell you, if you just take action through your methods, through micro movements, through whatever method works, actions and asking, and I like to say ask again and ask differently. So, because people always say, I asked and I didn't get it. And so I always say, did you ask again? Well, no, I didn't see the point. Okay, well, now you haven't asked again. Okay, ask differently. Did you do that? Well, no, I couldn't think of any other way to ask. Oh, there's a lot of ways to ask. I asked on the phone. Okay, did you ask in person? No. I asked by mail. Okay, did you send an email? No. I mean, so ask again, ask differently. Action comes before inspiration.
I love it. And I just saw a thing I do this all the time where I write, I am a big fan of index cards, especially. So I'll write something and I'll think, oh, that's pretty good. And then I stack it somewhere. And then I come across it and I'm like, oh, did I write that? That's pretty good. So I thought, so I wrote, inner doubt cannot be cured by outer approval.
Oh, yes, good. And I just saw another one that you wrote about desire and discipline.
Oh, yeah. I had a speaking gig today and Melanie Benson turned it into a meme on Facebook.
So what is the quote?
It's that you don't need more discipline, you need more desire.
Yes, that's a huge, major one.
Right, because we think like, oh, I'm so lazy, oh, I got to make myself do it. I know what I got to do, I just need to make myself do it. It's like, no. Put down the whip. Like, really, you're plenty disciplined, you're fine. You get all kinds of things done all the time. Don't worry about it. What you need is to amp up your desire.
Yeah, because the desire drives it all.
Exactly. And you may notice the things you really want to do, you pretty much kind of do.
You always, yeah. And so I'm always reminding people, don't do anything out of pressure, urgency, or scarcity, which if you'll notice spells pus.
Ooh.
Yeah. And then the other one is, don't do things out of fear, obligation, or guilt, which spells fog. So if you can stay out of those six places in any fashion, you're going to do really well.
So good. So good. What was I just thinking about? The before the discipline, the oh shoot, it was so good.
Oh, the one that you wrote on the other index card?
No. Mm. It'll come back to me or it won't. All right. Being special. Nope. All right, never mind. So we don't wait for inspiration. We take action and then we get inspired. And I know what it was. I knew it would come back.
Oh, good.
Is ask more specifically. Because I find all the time, it used to happen, especially when I was an actor, people would be like, I need an agent. And I'd be like, okay, well, what kind of agent are you looking for? Well, any agent, I just need an agent. It's like, okay, believe me, you do not want any agent. Right? You want the right agent for you.
Yeah.
So you need to get specific about like, I want a good mid-level agent who's been in the business for a while, likes women, you know, which isn't everybody. And maybe has some particular connections with the casting directors in comedy. Cause that's, I like to do that. Like, okay, now I can think of somebody for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Otherwise it's like you're walking around going like, I'm hungry. It's like, all right. You know, like, No, I'm hungry. It's my birthday. I love Mexican food and I've got a budget of $17.
Yay!
Now I know where to send you.
Yes. Oh, so well said, Sam.
Right. So ask again, ask differently, ask more specifically.
Yes. I love that addition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you and I could do this all night and on other nights have.
Along with you know, margaritas and other people.
It's happened. Oh my gosh. That, oh my goodness. Yeah. We'll talk about that night some other time. but thank you so much for sharing your beautiful, brilliant spirit with everybody. Is there anything you want to like leave everybody with?
Yeah, I want everyone to know I wrote them a book.
You wrote them a book?
Yeah. I wrote them the Micro Movement Miracle Method mini book.
So, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's 20, how many pages? I don't know, like 25 pages, and has micro movement. So this is how I've done. So I give wheels for more money, more love, more creativity, more self-care, more joy. They're all filled in. And then there's a blank one. And then the entire method, how to actually do it, is outlined in this book. And it's free for everyone in your symposium.
You win the freebie prize for best freebie. I'm just going to announce that. I'm just saying that right now. I don't even know what some of the other freebies are, but I think that's got to be the best one.
Yeah, it's so exciting. You know, I've had pieces of it in my different books and parts of it here and parts of it there. And I thought, why don't I write one? Can you believe this? After 17 books, I'd never written an ebook. Like, I'd never done it. I don't know what. I know. I just never did. And I thought, so now it exists. The Micro Movement Miracle Method. Do more of what you want more often and easily.
Perfect.
Here it is.
Perfect. And I love it that you got samples, because I know that shuts people down too. Like, some people feel like, oh, I'm not creative, I'm not artistic, I wouldn't know where to start. It's like, well, start by copying.
Start in a blank, wonderful wheel. And then if that scares you, you would have a filled in wheel with actual things to do and try. And then it gives every step. It's an entire system put together for your people.
That's gonna change lives.
Oh yeah. I mean, it again, the micro movement, I'm telling you, micro movement miracles. I mean, it's changed my life. This is, by the way, how I run my life. So it works for clutter clearing. It works for tax planning. It works for vacation planning. It works for healthcare. It works for all of it.
The love of your life.
Finding the love of your life. Exactly. I did, you know, I definitely used my own micro movement method to create John. Yeah. You know? And then I would tell everyone to really live by this is something I painted years ago that's called the clock of forgiveness. And I'll show it and then I'll read from it. That's what it looks like. And it says on the back, breathe. And it says on the clock, so starting up at the top on 12, it says, yes, it's okay, go back to sleep, call later, nap, quit, sleep, nap, it's okay, actually, I don't feel like it, go without me, no worries.
Yeah, I just felt several thousand people exhale. And then immediately start to worry, like, really? Really? Can I say that? Really? No, I could just nap and say no. And
that, yeah, that leads to my wonderful quote, the more naps you take, the more money you'll make.
I concur. I have had this experience.
Yeah, because when we have, money runs from tension and pressure. If we approach anything we're doing about money, it will just run. And with that tension pressure. But if you can find even a little, so let's use if you can find a micro bit of relaxation, the money will feel safe to come closer again. I found it with every book deal. I mean, I was doing 7-figure book deals. As soon as I tried to apply any kind of pressure, the deal would stop. You know, it was delayed, or the agent had to get back involved, or, you know, now we're sorry, but, you know, we need to do a 3-book deal, whatever it was. And when I relaxed, so and I'm doing it to this day. As soon as there's a big deal underway, I relax more. And again, it's counterintuitive, because you think you should be driven, you should stay on it. And yes, you do need to be focused. You do need to pay attention. But if you overdo, it will be absolutely what you do not want.
Well, I always say be busy and pay attention like a trapeze artist is busy and paying attention, right? Or like a neurosurgeon is busy and paying attention. Like, they're busy, they're paying attention, but they're not like wringing their hands. You know, they're not stressed out about it. They're just moving cleanly from one thing to the next thing with some level of grace. And I'll give you an example of what you're talking about. When my first book, when Get It Done, was coming out, and you know what it is with a book launch, like the number of things you have to do, the number of things that should have been done this morning, the number of things that should have been done 3 years ago, like there's a lot of things you could be doing. And when my body like sometimes communicates with me backwards. So I would find myself at my desk thinking the thought, I have to do something and I don't know what it is. And I realized that thought was actually my body saying, go take a nap. And so I have to do something and I don't know what it is. And I would get up, and this is the advantage of working from home, I realized, but I would get up, I'd walk into the bedroom, and sometimes I'd walk into the bedroom and go, oh, I know what I have to do. And then I'd come back to my desk and do it. Sometimes I would lay down and sleep for 4 hours. And sometimes I would just lay there and read for 20 minutes and just like take a little rest and then come back. But you're exactly right. Anything that I tried to create in that like, no, no, I have to keep going. I have to do more. Like it all just went to shit immediately.
Yes.
Talk about a magical fertilizer adventure. Like it would just go to shit.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's a beautiful example, Sam.
But anything I did when I was like calm and rested and chilled out, like it didn't all go my way. But it went.
Yeah. Yeah. And you felt much better along the way. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, you can use your will and you can force things. And yeah, some things will happen, but you'll feel miserable and crabby and tense and you'll torture everyone around you. And most of all yourself.
Right.
And yeah.
There was the nap I laid down for and I did wake up 3 hours later and $7,500 had come in while I was asleep. I was like, this is good. This is a good nap.
Exactly. I mean, that is what I'm talking about. I have so many examples like that too. And you know, you just reminded me, I forgot to let people know that I sometimes work privately with people as a mentor.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah, I forgot to say that.
And they should know that.
Yeah, they should know that. So if they go to planetsarc.com under mentoring, they'll find an application, and if it's open, they'll be able to apply. And if it's closed, it will say some lovely thing. And then they can, you know, find me other ways. I'm everywhere and everywhere and nowhere. But I forget to mention these things. And then I find out later, well, why didn't you say that? You know, I think of it. Oh yeah, I forgot to invite people, you know.
Exactly. You have to invite them again and invite them differently. But yes. Yeah, you know, you've been hearing a lot, almost everybody on this series has talked about the importance of mentorship, the importance of getting coaching, the importance of a good teacher. Yeah, so if y'all are feeling a little drawn to SARC, then this, I would go and fill out that application, even if it means you're getting on the waiting list. Okay. You are so beautiful. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Sam. What a joy you are. How beautiful you look. How talented you are. How much I appreciate the realness of you. And I know everyone listening feels that way too, that even if it's not your favorite part of yourself, it could be others' favorite part of you.
Which brings us to a whole nother conversation about how, like what other people think of you and your work is kind of not only not up to you and something you have absolutely no control over, but kind almost none of your business.
Oh yeah, I'll say one of my great therapists said to me one time, I will know that you've really made progress when you can take the complaints and the compliments equally.
Yep, exactly. It's all just results.
And I remember thinking, but no, I like the compliments so much more. And then it was like, oh, okay, finding your worth through your work is not really what you want to be doing. Because then you're subject to, someone asked me the other day, have you ever heard this about yourself? I said, I have heard everything, literally. I mean, the worst things you can ever imagine, I've read them or heard them. And I'm happy to say now that I really don't care. I mean, I'm not saying I can't get hurt and there might not be something that affects me, but in general, I don't care. And what a freedom that is. And I wish that for everyone.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Yeah. This is entrepreneurship and creativity as spiritual development. Like
you start. Oh, it's the biggest spiritual development you'll ever do. Yeah. I mean, if you have entrepreneurial leanings and desires, it's the biggest spiritual development you'll ever do.
Yeah. A lot of it is getting past that. Like, who do I think I am? What if they criticize me? What if they really criticize me? What if I fail? What if I fail publicly in a really embarrassing way and lose all my money? Susan and I have both done all of those things. And
I'm raising all 4 feet. Oh, and before we go, we're having trouble going, but we ought to tell people the other great, big, wonderful thing that we share, and it involves the color white.
Susan, I have the same. The fact that we're like dressed up for y'all is pretty. You should feel the compliment, because almost every day, Susan and I both wear nothing but giant, oversized white men's shirts. Lately, preferably from Target, I have to say.
Target is my favorite. Crisp white cotton. And we did not discover this right away. Didn't it sort of come out like I didn't know anyone else that did such a thing.
Yeah. And then I used to borrow my dad's when I was in high school. I used to borrow his shirts and wear them all the time. And now I just buy my own, like 5 at a time. I mean.
Oh, yeah. And then let's have a conversation another time about the quality of cotton. And changes in the market, and you know, I have lots to say.
I know long staple Egyptian cotton, you can't hardly even find it anymore.
I knew you would know.
And how cotton gets so perfect right before it rips.
You know,
it's like the cruel trick of cotton.
I know. Oh, well, clearly another time and more.
Totally, we'll have to have a gathering. All of us will wear our white shirts, and we'll.
Yeah, this is baby sign language for more.
More. If you've enjoyed this, but your time is limited and you'd like access to the rest of them, please hop over to therealsambennett.com/freedom. That's therealsambennett.com/freedom. And there you can opt in, get access to all these recordings and a bunch of fun freebies. We'd love to see you there. In the meantime, remember, the world needs your good work. Thanks, everybody.